Starting Fellowship Afternoon Sessions, March 8th at 1800 WET Tech, Alex Surratt.
I think that we've all had a long day today. Everybody looks a little bit more tired than I saw you at 7 o'clock this morning. How's everybody doing? Yay! Everybody's good? Everybody's good? Yeah?
Yeah.
All right, yeah? That sounded a little bit fake. That sounded a little... There's some of you who just aren't, can't even try right now. It's okay. It's all right. We are going to start our session. We are about 2 minutes in, so we're doing really well. I'm proud of us. Good job. Thank you for arriving on time. I think we're still missing a handful, but that's okay. We're going to start with a presentation or a discussion with our NOMCOM and about the NOMCOM, and we're also going to, at 6:30, have a conversation about the GAC. Our previously scheduled speaker had a calendar mishap that was probably my email's fault. And so Tracy Hackshaw is here. And so at 6:30, he is going to come up and talk about the GAC and answer some more of your questions, hopefully in some more detail than I was able to, despite my my little presentation that I was able to give you on our last session. So please take it away. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Jeannie. Hi, my name's Stefan Van Gelder. I chair the nominating committee. To my left is Hans-Petter Holen, who is the chair-elect. I'll explain what that means in a minute. And we have Wolfgang as well, Kleinwächter, who's the associate chair. So you have the full nominating committee leadership team with you. I'll explain all that in a minute. Just a few words by means of introduction. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. We make sure that we take the time to meet with the fellowship attendees at every ICANN meeting. We feel it's very important, and that means some of you may have heard us speak before, in which case I apologize. This might be slightly redundant, but I'm hoping that there's sufficiently high number of new fellows in the room to keep it interesting. And even if you have heard it before, every time we've done this, we've had some very engaging and interesting questions. So I'm sure that will continue. What is the nominating committee? The nominating committee is ICANN's way of bringing outside blood, new blood, or different people to its key leadership positions. As I'm sure you've discovered in your meanderings around the ICANN meeting, ICANN is a community that can sometimes be obscure, closed, or difficult to penetrate. And that means that inherently you tend to get in leadership positions those people that are ICANN regulars rather than getting people that may bring new perspectives into ICANN's work. So to counteract that effect, a nominating committee was created. A nominating committee itself is not a new governance tool. It's something that's used by many boards. Many organizations use nominating committees to recruit and do what we do. So that's not new, but what the ICANN nominating committee does is enable people that would not necessarily have heard of ICANN before to participate in this unique governance experiment that you've heard all about and that is ICANN, and that's a pretty exciting place in my mind at any rate, and I'm sure all the volunteers that you've heard from will have told you the same thing, is a pretty unique and exciting thing to be part of. Even though it does consume time, even though we do give a lot of our time. We do volunteer a lot of our time, all of us that are here, which means that, yes, we do look a bit haggard at the end of the day. Well, I look sporty. He looks haggard. But, you know, my day started a little later than yours, but it's been a full day of meetings and panels, etc. So one lesson that I've learned and that you might want to take on board if you choose to continually participate in ICANN is to take whatever free time you can get. So mine was 30 minutes in the gym just before this, and I'm glad it meant my brain was a bit refreshed. So back to the NOMCOM. I wanted to explain what we do. I now want to explain what we're doing this year specifically, because each NOMCOM is a unique cycle. It's a standalone body that works for a year and serves for a year. So to give you an example, this year we are recruiting three people for the ICANN Board of Directors. I'll let Hans Better go into the detail in a minute. One seat of the GNSO Council, one seat on the CCNSO Council, and two seats on the At-Large Advisory Committee. So we are going to go out. We're very much working as an outreach, ambassador, recruitment kind of role. We're going out using all channels that we can, including yours. I mean, the message here is for you, but it's also for your networks, if you know of people that might be interested to participate and to apply to the NOMCOM. We use all those channels to try and get people to apply to these positions. Generally, we are quite successful. We get, on average, around 100 applications per year for this general number of seats, so, you know, less than 10 seats. So it's quite a tough process. Once we have, so we open an application window. This year it closes on March the 20th, so that's close by. And at that point, once it's closed, we then go into assessment and selection, and I'll let my co-chairs explain that process in a minute. What I do want to say, though, before we go into the detail of the process, is that this specific process really is about reaching out to this type of community as well. People that will bring, as I said, into ICANN different points of views, different cultures, I think that's very important, it's all about diversity. And diversity has many forms. It's also diversity of language. It's also diversity of habits. It's diversity of problem solving, because ICANN does a lot of problem solving or problem non-solving, but at least we try. So all those different approaches, this is what the NOMCOM's designed to do. And it is important because the NOMCOM recruits, if you just take the ICANN board, we recruit to half the ICANN board. 50% of the ICANN board is populated by the nominating committee. So this is an important chunk of work, and it's something that I'm hopeful you'll be interested to at least observe, if not involve yourself in. Hans Petter, can I pass it to you?
Thank you, Stefan. So Stefan has told you all about the position. So how do you apply? Anybody know that? Oh, exactly, online. Of course, we use the internet for everything, right? It's a very good one. There is a URL called nomcom.icann.org, and you will find all the information you need there. The deadline is on the 20th of March. And then that's when the application period closes. We still allow for all the applicants to update their forms before we go into evaluating the forms. Then we use a professional recruitment firm to do the first round of interviews for the boards, while we do the first round of interviews for the other positions ourselves. And then the challenge in front of us that we spend a couple of months on is actually to reduce the list of 100 to let's say a 10 for the three seats and so on. So if we have seven seats in the different positions altogether, we may not bring it down to 20, 25, 30 at most. And then we need to go into on-site interviews at the next ICANN meeting, where we'll invite the candidates we have shortlisted after we've done the gotten the result from the professional firm as input to our process, and we've done online research and checked references, and then we do face-to-face interviews of the board candidates there. And then after that's done, the process is like when they select a pope in the Vatican. We're locked in a hotel and we have to agree on who to select to the positions before we're allowed to go home. And after that, there is a due diligence process done by the ICANN Legal to see that the persons that we have appointed are actually who they say they are, and they don't have any... They're legally qualified to fill the positions of an U.S. Californian corporations. There are some. We're living in the real world, so the lawyers have some say on formal qualifications, like not being convicted and so on. And then, when all this is cleared, we announce the candidate, and they take the seat at the autumn ICANN meeting later this year. And then when that's done, this NOMCOM is done, and a new NOMCOM takes over. And as Stefan mentioned, I'm chair-elect this year, so that means that if I do a good job, the ICANN board may appoint me as chair for next year's NOMCOM. And what does Wolfgang do? Yes, you want to tell us that, Wolfgang?
Hey, thank you very much. My name is Wolfgang Kleinwächter. You know, I belong to this old veterans of ICANN. That's my 51st ICANN meeting. So I went through this organization in many positions. I was 6 years in the NOMCOM, 2 years in the GNSO Council, 2 years in the board. So I know quite well, you know, what are the expectations. You know, let me add to what Stefan and Hans-Peter said, two remarks, one on history and the other one on philosophy. If you go back to the history books of ICANN, when ICANN was designed 18 years ago, the idea was, you know, how to create a decision-making body and how to populate this. And the original idea of the people who drafted the first bylaws was, okay, the first thing was let's put the governments in advisory capacity and then to have a balance in the board between the provider of the services, you could say the private sector, and the user of the services. You could say it is a civil society, so, and to have a balanced 9-9. So, but how to find the representative of the users? So the first idea was elections. So we organized in the year 2000 a global election for at least 5 seats. It was like a pilot project. Can this work? And so election took place. More than 200,000 people participated in the elections. And we learned a lot of lessons that we say, okay, if we will continue this way with elections, we end up with 4 billion voters. Nobody can manage an election with 4 billion voters because every email owner had a right to participate in the election. So that means in the reform, which ICANN started in the years 2001 and 2002, we said, okay, we have to move to a selection process, not an election process, but the selection process has to be as democratic as possible and has to guarantee that the voice of the users can be heard also in the board. So, and this brings me to my second point, to philosophy. I think the nomination committee is probably the most democratic element in the ICANN architecture because the community itself selects its leadership. So that means each constituency, the supporting organization, the advisory committee, send voting members to the nomination committee. So the chair-elect and the associated chair are non-voting members. It's the community which has the vote to select their representatives. This is really a very important element. It's not a group of special experts who handpick some candidates. It's the community which has the power to select the candidates. And I think this is really important to know that is part of the issue of accountability, which we are discussing now also in a broader way. But the nomination committee is an important element of this whole system of accountability. These are the 2 points I wanted to raise. Thank you. And if you have questions, all of 3 of us are happy to answer.
Thanks. Thanks, Wolfgang. Perhaps if I just, before I just open it up for questions, just to add two things. First of all, on the leadership team itself, to add to what my two colleagues have said, this body has specifics in terms of its leadership and the succession planning that's built into it. So the three of us represent that. Hans Petter and myself are chosen by the board. So the chair and the chair-elect, the current year and the next year's chair are chosen by the board, which may or may not have its own issues, but I don't want to get into that now. And the associate chair is chosen by the chair. So this year I chose or asked Wolfgang if he would do us the honor of participating. The idea behind that is that this year was a bit of a hiccup, but in standard years you have the outgoing chair becomes the associate chair, so is there to advise the incoming chair and provide experience. And then the chair-elect is there to observe and learn so that the following year he's she's effective as well. I wanted to stress that because you won't find that in many other groups. There's not much succession planning that goes on at ICANN leadership level yet, which may be a problem. And I also wanted to explain how we are selected, that the board selects us to, and that is something that in the community model that Wolfgang has described for the rest of the nominating committee, that our position is slightly different. So that's it, and we'd be very happy to answer some of your questions.
Good evening. I'm Mark Datskoud from Brazil. My question is, I understand the points you made, but what amount of oversight and what kind of oversight does the community have once the final decision has been reached? That's my question. Thank you.
I'm going to answer a different question, and then I'll try and answer yours, like every good politician. But the question I thought you were going to ask is how much oversight the community has during the process. And the NOMCOM has worked in the last few years very hard to make sure the community has a very, very transparent view of the work that we do, up until one thing that must absolutely always remain confidential and that we're very adamant must remain confidential, which is candidate information. So we don't disclose who the candidates are for obvious reasons. People may be applying whilst they're in current jobs and may not want their employers to know, or any other set of circumstances which would mean that, you know, this process would fail if we disclose candidate information. But apart from that, we are working very hard to make our processes as transparent as possible. I'll give you an example. Tomorrow we have at what time is it, Jai? 11?
10:45.
We have at 10:45 in the room that Joette's just said. We have our open meeting, and that is our effort to work in front of the community. One of the things that we'll do during that open meeting is discuss and take input from the community on the types of questions we should be asking candidates when we shortlist them and come to interview them. So on that aspect of accountability, I think we're working hard and getting results. Now, back to your question, which was accountability once the decision has been made. And that really, I think, is review and the ability to understand how our appointees, the people we've selected and put in these positions, are doing. And that's something slightly different. Do you want to speak to that?
Well, I don't know what you had in mind, but I wanted to add two things. And one is that we publish monthly report cards during the process to tell you what's going on, so you can read what process we're following. And there is also a final report by the chair at the end of the period, where there is also improvement suggestions for the next cycle. As any other ICANN body, there is also a review of the NOMCOM every now and then, and I think the next one is scheduled for 2017. So if I'm chair then, I will every 5 years. So then there will be a review by an independent body of the, how the NOMCOM works. But in the end, the only way you can see whether we did a good job or not is to look at the directors and see, do they do a good job or not?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that the principle of confidentiality is an instrument to protect the candidates. It's not a conspiracy, because probably you read articles. Kieran McCarthy has written about this in the Register, that is conspiracy in the nomination committee. This is totally nonsense, and I explain you why. Because if we would open the process and would announce the names of the candidates, then we would end up with election. Then you would have a campaign. People would, you know, start an election campaign and to get more votes. But the selection process follows a certain scheme, because we select this year 3 board members and we have 13 sitting board members. And in the final plate, if we have 10 candidates on the shortlist, all 10 candidates probably are fit for the board. We have excellent candidates, but then we have to select the candidates which fit into the balance of the board as a whole. So that means if we have 10 lawyers in the board, there is no need to have an 11th lawyer in the board, even if we have an excellent lawyer under the candidates. If we have no engineer in the board, and then we say we have to take an engineer, and look for an excellent engineer. So that means you have to have a lot of criteria, gender balance, geographical balance, skill balance, and all this, which finally influences the decision. And in so far, you know, to keep the names of the candidates confidential is an instrument to protect the candidate. And once again, that's why I explained it, the democracy, you know, with the selection of the voting members of the NOMCOM. It's extremely difficult to have a cabal in the NOMCOM, because, you know, it's such a diverse group, and the next year you have another NOMCOM. So that means you cannot build a foundation for what Kieran McCarthy has said is a conspiracy. This is really nonsense.
Thanks, Wolfgang. I'll take another question, although I would suggest that if we have a board with 10 lawyers on it, then we're definitely doing something wrong.
Well, I think I still want to go back to the question that was asked by my fellow Amaditola from Nigeria. I would think it was not talking about the process. It was talking about key performance index. How do you, you employ somebody? Now, is it the board that will measure the key performance indicators, or is it the community? So my thinking would be, because the community has selected the board, and the board will be acting on behalf of the community. That's my thinking. The response to the question would have been, thank you.
Thanks. So, you know, as usual, and this is exactly the trend I've seen in the past, we're getting some excellent questions, and I'm always impressed by the amount of depth you put into the thinking processes when you ask us stuff. I mean, this is a crucial point, and one that the NOMCOM has struggled with for many years. Your expectation that because the committee puts the people on there, the committee should follow, would make sense if it was the same committee. One of the things that we've struggled with is that the NOMCOM disbands. The NOMCOM, as I said, is a yearly process. It disbands at the end of the year, and then it's a different NOMCOM. To me, personally, my personal opinion, that shouldn't preclude a follow-up NOMCOM from looking at performance of past NOMCOM appointees, NCAs. But it's something that the community and the NOMCOM has struggled with, and we haven't found exactly the right answer yet. However, yes, when you put people in these positions, the bodies themselves are supposed to evaluate. So some do, some don't. The board has an internal review process. It's not published to the community, and that's the board decision. So, you know, it's difficult for even the NOMCOM to see, you know, what's been done in the past. Has that been effective or not? Apart from, obviously, conversations. You know, you can talk to people in corridors, and people can tell you, well, that guy's good and that woman's not good or whatever. But apart from that, there's no process. And the other bodies have some kind of review or do not. You know, it depends. So there's no the KPIs as such as you would use on a project do not exist, and that's probably something that the community needs to continue working on. Any more questions, please?
Madhvi from Mauritius, first-time fellow. What do you mean by the voting members on the non-com? So,
yeah, some of them, or most of the members on the non-com are voting members. So theirs are sent by the supporting organizations. The leadership, the three of us, do not vote. Okay. So we're here just to facilitate the process. And then we have non-voting vendor from the ITF. And
so what roles? Okay,
So just to explain that, we have some of these RSAC and SAC just sent us. Okay, so all the way through the process, we work on evaluating the candidates, and everybody works on reducing the list, and we do that through straw polling, right? And then we end up in the end, we have one final vote, which actually confirms that this is the result, and then it's only the voting members that gets to vote on that final slate.
Okay. So. Now I have another question. Okay. So you say that every year the NOMCOM gets disbanded and you have a new NONCOM. Has it happened that the same voting members form part of the NONCOM?
Yes. As a member of the NOMCOM, you can only serve for 2 years. So it's up to your supporting organization to decide whether they will send you back the year after. So the two last years before I became chair-elect, I was sent here by the Numbers Resource Organization, the ASO, Address Supporting Organization, and they sent me for 2 years. But that meant that, on average, half the NOMCOM is changed every year. But it's not the same NOMCOM.
It's a one-year term. So you can serve 2 one-year terms. Wolfgang.
I just want to add that the Governmental Advisory Committee was invited to join the NOMCOM, but the governments have decided to reject this invitation for two reasons. One is the representative of the Governmental Advisory Committee would have to base his intervention on GAC consensus. And this would be not possible by respecting the principle of confidentiality. So insofar, it was the government who decided themselves not to join the nomination committee. So it's not that we have excluded the GAC. So they can send if they delegate it to one candidate. So it's an open door. But they have decided not to participate in the NOMCOM. And the governmental representative in the board is a non-voting liaison in the board.
Thanks. Any further questions?
We probably have time for two more questions.
Please.
Hashim Noman from Pakistan. I have a small question. Do you have any young members, very young members, on the nominating committee?
What, apart from myself? No, we're not very age diverse, and that's another good question. I struggle to think of a reason because we, the leadership team, don't have any input into the election process for the members. The organizations that elect NOMCOM members, we don't input in. So why do they select older people? I don't know. It may be that no one else wants to do it. It may be that they want the experience. I have no idea, to be honest, of the age range of the NOMCOM members. And perhaps it's something that we should look at. It's an excellent question. Yeah, sure. Joette and Gia here, they are our two staff support, and we couldn't live without them.
Yes, they are a crew to keep track of. On the note of
age,
thank you. It's a long day. The other thing with respect to, you know, age on the members of the committee The other thing is gender balance. This year we have two females on the committee and the rest are men. So it's something in addition to always trying to balance the candidate pool so that we can get more women in leadership roles within ICANN. We also look forward, and maybe we'll discuss with this leadership team how we best can encourage the organizations and committees that give us members to the next nominating committee, that we can get a more gender balance on our committee. So that's all.
Okay, to follow up on that, anybody know what date it is today?
I do.
So what's special with today other than it's my daughter's birthday? Exactly, Women's Day. So in the slate so far, we have 81 males and 10 women for the positions here. So why aren't more women applying for the positions?
There are busy celebrating International Women's Day. So.
Yeah. The other thing to think about, we know in Africa, out of the 92 applications, there are 15 from Africa. And that's half as from Europe and Asian Pacific and USA. So please go home and consider whether you or some of your friends want to be in any of these positions.
Thanks, Hans-Petter. I wonder if there's any link between the fact that the NOMCOM is full of old men and no women want to apply to it. But anyway, please. So who was it first?
Is that...
Just quickly, my name is Arsene Tungali, and I'm glad to be a second-time fellow. My question is, first question is, what does it require to be an ICANN board member? And maybe the second question would be, what are the criteria for you to select Wolfgang? Is he the associate chair?
Yeah. Why did you...
He's a
friendly German, so you know. they're quite rare, so I thought I'd choose him. But I'll just, in the interest of time, I don't want to avoid your question, but I know we're running up against someone else. So, and there's two other people. In the interest of time, the skill set for the board is published on our website, nomcom.icann.org, and under that URL, you'll have it's a breakdown by year. So if you click on 2016, you'll find the skill set that the board has sent us. So we don't invent the skill sets. Each group's, we go to each group and say, what do you need this year? And they send us skill sets, which we publish so that the applicants can see. So that's on the site. On the associate chair, as perhaps, I'm not sure you were there, before we explain that this succession planning for the leadership team is starts with him. He's chair-elect is training, chair is chairing, and associate chair is generally the chair the year before, there to advise the chair. So we've got the experience of the year before, chairing and a new person learning. This year it's just been slightly different, but one of the reasons I chose Wolfgang is that he's chaired the NOMCOM in the past, apart from the fact that he's got huge experience and he was an outgoing board member when I chose him, which meant he could help us also with understanding the board. Thank you.
It's just, I think, adding to Arsene's question, because in the start, I'm Hiba from Sudan. In the start, you said that the NOMCOM is a way to channel new blood to the board. Mm-hmm. But I'm a newcomer. I'm still confusing about the whole ICANN structure. So do you think, you know, the process of channeling people who are just will be diving in the deep water, is it effective or maybe... comparing to having someone who already went through the constitution and the working group and then being elected. Do you have any kind of, I don't know, assessment for that or something like that?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, because it helps me to tell you that we recruit for four groups, not just the board. And one perfect way into this process is to apply for something else. For example, apply for ALAC, the at-large advisory committee, which is, or you know, one of the councils. That's a way to learn the ropes as well. It's a less high-pressure way to learn the ropes. It is indeed unlikely that someone who has absolutely no knowledge, experience, or history at all with the internet or this environment would be selected to the board first time. However, it is, and it does regularly happen, that people that are new get selected to these other positions, understand, and then progress to further leadership positions. Indeed, I might add, very much alike to what happens with the fellows. We see many fellows that come in, learn the ropes, and then you find them in key leadership positions within ICANN. So it's much the same thinking. Do we have time for one more? I know you wanted to ask a question. Yeah.
I just wanted to expand on the question that my colleague here asked on the diversity of age. I like the model that you're using for the leadership continuity. And I'm looking at now, how is there a program that you have young, aspiring, you know, leaders of tomorrow, that you put them on the mentorship, and then you make sure that when they now become as old as you are, they're able to lead and with experience from the past. I just wanted to find out on that one.
So you were, when you said as old as you were looking at him.
Well, I got involved in this 16 years ago when ICANN was formed. So then I was young. When I got on the NOMCOM, I actually challenged some of the old members from my community. Right, they're 10, 15 years older than me that had been here. Hmm? So and yes,
and they're not dead.
No. So no. So what I'm trying to say to you is that if you're a member of ALAC or something else, raise your hand and say that I would like to be on NOMCOM next year. I would like to be on the committee, because those that get elected by habit because we've been here so long, maybe we need a sort of kick back to sort of let place for young blood. So I mean, it's all about the initiative.
On the note that Stefan was saying about how important this group is, the fellowship program is really important to get new participants within the whole organization of ICANN. But also, I just want to point out that this year we have Amir, who is a fellow alumni, and he is now part of the at-large advisory committee from the Asia Pacific, right?
Yeah.
Aprelo. So he's on the. This will be his first year. So, you know, participate, and yeah, things can happen. So.
Yeah. Thanks, Joette. I actually should have said something because I saw Amir come in, so that was my bad. So I think we'll bring it to a close.
Just a short comment.
All right.
So after attending like 3 days of all kinds of sessions, your work seems simple enough to me as a newcomer.
You couldn't be further. No, it's a serious point. You couldn't be further from the truth. It's extremely complicated to do this. For two reasons. First of all, as Wolfgang explained earlier on, because the whole community is represented on the NOMCOM, people have to come together and agree, and they have very different points of view and very different objectives and perspectives. So that's not simple. The other reason it's difficult is the quality of the applicants themselves. And that, honestly, I've been on the NOMCOM since 2013, and in those 3 years, the quality has shot up. It was high already, and that makes it very difficult as well. You know, Wolfgang said if we shortlist it to 10 candidates, those are 10 excellent candidates. So it's a lot of work. As once the application period closes, we meet every week. We have to winnow down the pool. It's a lot of work, but if we make it look simple, that's okay.
I think you just explain it very, very well. They had a very full morning this morning, listening to the non-commercial stakeholder group and trying to piece everything together this week and see how everything fits. This was by far one of not. I don't want to go back and say simple, but one of the easier structures, I think, to absorb. And so thank you very much. That was a very thorough presentation and very easy to understand. I learned something new, and I've been at ICANN now for 9 years. So thank you.
Perfect. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, Tracy, we're going to move to our next presenter as quickly as we can. Thank you very much, Stefan. So as riveting as my presentation on the GAC, I'm sure was, it was probably not quite as thorough as this gentleman's will be. He will be able to give you a perspective. Tracy Hackshaw is a former vice chair of the GAC and is currently a mentor and also a fellowship alumni. And so we love to have Tracy here. And he's going to talk to you about being a GAC member and what that experience is like, and a little bit more about how the GAC operates. I was able to give you an overview of how the GAC operates, and he can give you a bit of a more in-depth view of that from the government perspective rather than from my amazing perspective, by the way. So,
thank you. I'm sure Jeannie's presence was extraordinarily amazing. It was, yes. All right, so so I'm Tracy Hackshaw. I'm a fellow, just like you, once a fellow, always a fellow, as they say. Who here is from the government? Anybody in the room? Okay, do you know your GAC rep? Yes? Yes, kind of. Good. So Jeannie would have talked to you a bit about how the GAC operates. I wouldn't want to bore you with that today. I'll take questions, and just to let you know that the key for the GAC and how it should be operating is that you should get to know who your GAC rep is. I think that's very important because governments, they're meeting now. I think they may still be meeting. Governments believe, I'm from the government, that they represent their constituents, of which businesses, academia, technical people, civil society, all are part of. So if you don't know your GAC rep or you don't speak to your GAC rep, then they represent you without you having spoken to them. And as you know, they're discussing the accountability issue right now. And several countries have stated their views, but are those your views? Have you spoken to your GAC rep? Brazil, have you spoken to your GAC rep? Do you know what Brazil's views are on the GAC? There's a Brazilian fellow. Yes? Who's the Brazilian fellow in the room? Or fellows? There's one there.
There's one.
Ah. Yes. So did you speak? Do you know what their view is on the accountability process? Right. So it's good stuff. Look at it. It's all on the ICANN website. There's a minority statement of which Brazil has spearheaded. And the GAC website is a very good source of information. It's being revamped now, but today, if you go to the GAC website, you will see most of what Jeannie would have presented on Monday, and you'd also see briefs on introduction to the GAC and how the GAC operates and so on. So, again, I'm not going to bore you with how the GAC operates, but maybe it's better to just take some questions. Jeannie, what do you think?
Please.
That'd be great. Yes. All right, so I'm free to answer questions and any specific issues that you would like me to raise?
One, two.
For the records, Bram at the Tallers College, and Sonam as well. So I've always asked this question. I think I remember last time I also asked you this question. How does GAC follow up on? Because if you go to the GAC website, you find that there's a list. I saw Maritza saying, kind of, we know the government representatives, but surely some of them are not here. And this is equally a very important issue that they have to represent our government. Does GAC do anything in terms of follow-up when there are meetings like this, crucial meetings like these ones, to see if the members that represent different governments are participating or have
members,
their views?
I'm lost. Members represent different governments?
Yes.
GAC, so I kind of lost your question there. What exactly is the question?
The question is, does GAC follow up on its members when they are, I know, like, even the accountability issue, does it follow up with all its members that are registered as representative
right,
of...
The GAC is not a thing. The GAC is a committee, right, of people.
Yes, yes.
So the GAC can't follow up on its own members, and the members of the GAC are members of the GAC. So the question I think you're asking is whether the GAC, the chair of the GAC, does any work with the GAC members intersectionally?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're trying to ask?
Yes, yes.
Right, so the way the GAC doesn't only work in face-to-face meetings. They do have intersectional meetings, mm-hmm. and they do correspond quite copiously on email in between meetings. So using the accountability process as an example, the work that led up to this meeting didn't start here. It would have started, especially the positions that have been adopted by the minority governments would have been going through from the last October meeting to now, from Dublin to now. So you've seen a lot of discussion from the last communique on what the GAC said to what happened in the last set of accountability discussions around February or so when the report was produced. So as an example, certain members felt that the discussion that, or the agreements that they made in October were not followed through in February. So they then worked together collectively and came up with their own views. And the members themselves, there's nobody leading the discussion. So the GAC members themselves would have done that. On occasion, the GAC executive, the chair or the vice chairs would come in and say, okay, well, we want to do a conference call to see that now that we've seen all of these views, let's have a conference call together before this meeting to kind of air your own views and see if there's consensus or divergence on opinions and so on. But the GAC itself doesn't track itself because GAC members are the governments are autonomous. If you understand what I'm getting at. So governments, they don't expect the GAC to track them. Governments are autonomous on their own. They're sovereign in that sense. So from that standpoint, I don't think it's a GAC tracking itself. But the GAC chair does do some work in looking after and make sure that the membership is heard if views are expressed.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when we were talking about how Monday, when we were talking about how governments become members of the GAC and how they're each individual and that forms the committee? That's sort of what we're talking about in the committee as a whole. It's each individual government is sort of responsible for them for themselves.
Yeah.
So when you go back to thinking about that overall structure, when I explained the overall structure, the GAC itself, it's calling it the GAC is I think part of the the governmental advisory committee. It's a little bit more complicated than that, because each government is represented there on their own behalf. So similar to when another member of the community might not be speaking on behalf of their own organization, they're speaking on their own behalf. They're not representing the view of the GAC, they're representing the view of their government. So it's only in GAC communications that it's the view of the... Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Okay. So do we then question our government when they're not actively involved in the GAC meetings? Or, I mean, I'm here, I'm not,
so
not as someone from GAC.
I would be cautious, because if you haven't set up a rapport with your governments before and they don't understand what you are trying to say or express, then it'll be very difficult to berate them for not participating. As I said before, it's very good, and I always say this when I come to meetings like this, for you to get to know your GAC rep and to have a view. Even if you're an individual, it's fine. GAC members are people, they're human beings. So you can pick up the phone, call them. I'm sure your ministry has a phone number. I like to speak to, so-and-so. Hi, I understand you're a GAC rep. I have a very particular view about this issue. I'm 100% certain they'll be shocked first that somebody's calling them, but they will also say, "Oh, sure, let's set up a meeting." I'm reasonable because they would want to hear from their constituents in that regard. GAC members are generally technocrats; they're not ministers, they're not as high as prime minister or minister. So they're just people working in government, and they would love to hear from their yeah, exactly.
Okay, from the GAC website, I kind of found two names. Madhvi from Mauritius. I have found two names of government officials that are part of the GAC. Now, I know there is a reshufflement happening there, and that maybe would explain why we don't have a representative here at the moment. But in terms of, you know, ensuring that each government is represented, you know, in the policy making or in involving in themselves in what ICANN does. So, what is the way it works in a GAC? You know,
What you just said?
Like I said, there is staff turnover. These representatives may retire, for example, or they may be reshuffled from the Ministry of ICT to another ministry because they're technocrats. And I know this is happening at the moment in my country. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens? You know, does the chain get broken? Or does the GAC take care of itself?
All right, so, again, these are individuals, yes. However, governments are, I guess, slightly different to, let's say, the ALAC, how the ALAC would operate. So individuals in the GAC, there are 160 countries now plus in the GAC, and 160 members, I should say, 160 countries. And the challenge we are facing, if members are shifting, then you would think that positions change. But more than likely in a country, there, at least in most of the countries, there's some sort of structure in place for positions on things like internet governance or for DNS and so on. So it is very unlikely that if a country doesn't participate in 1 year or two, that when they come back, they will simply be, will have a new position on the internet governance, because a country's position should be a country's position. Now, that's not disputing the fact that when governments change, positions change on policy. Or in some countries, I mean, I don't want to say this necessarily on record, but some people may be presenting their own views as a GAC member. I don't know. If that's the case, then what you're saying will be very challenging, in that if that individual leaves the GAC, then the person who's coming in to replace him or her might not be aware of what's happening. So in that situation, in those situations, you'd have challenges. But by and large, most countries have structures in place that would allow GAC members coming in, if they're new, to follow through from previous notes, from policy, and when they come, they're going to speak to the country's position. Even if the position changes, it's going to be a position. You don't tend to find GAC reps, at least the ones from the larger countries in particular, shifting from what they call capital's position. And you tend to find a lot of countries going back to capital to respond to just things that happen in the meeting. So they may not say anything in the meeting, but they may say something in the next meeting or during the meeting, because they have to consult with capital, as they call it, and come back and say, okay, now that we've consulted in alignment with the WSIS position of this or this position we took in the ITU, we now view this as so on and so forth, so on and so forth. So that's a long answer to that question, but I think it's clearer there. So it depends, but more likely you would not see shifting views or shifting positions if countries' members change or rotate. Shouldn't. Not supposed to.
Aditola is my name. I'm from Nigeria, a fellow. Part of my question you answered in the response to our question. I've asked this question before, and it's still in line with that. But when I was at the GAC meeting yesterday, I witnessed the meeting twice, and that's reaffirmed what my questions were. I think countries at the present at the GAC were we're discussing our long international diplomacy line. Of course, we know what some countries, Brazilian view was not strange to me, for example, if we have been following international diplomacy outside ICANN, the view from China or the view from somebody from or Iran, for example. You know, once we know what the countries have been doing outside ICANN. Now, there is a tendency of those countries bringing that international diplomacy into ICANN. And we witnessed that during the GAC meeting yesterday. Now, the question I want to ask is, these countries have different laws, their country laws. We read some years back when there was a case with Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates with BlackBerry saying that the data should remain in their country, not resident in Canada. Now, does ICANN have different contracts with different countries? Would that be the purview, within the purview of the GAC to say, these are laws within our country. We don't want our internet-based domain or whatever to be resident in America, for example. We want it to remain in the United Arab Emirates. We want it to remain in Africa or things like that. What will GAC do? And how does that affect ICANN operation?
That's an extremely sensitive question. Now, first things first, ICANN doesn't control content or doesn't work with content. That's a big point. So I could only answer the question about if on the DNS side, I guess. So previously in the old ICANN, so the old GAC discussions before the politics came in, the technical discussions about the security, the DNS, and so on, were generally very neutral views or discussions, generally. So security and stability of the DNS, wherever you host a website or whatever you do. So that there's, from the standpoint of the GAC and ICANN, from a technical view, there should be no political discussion, let's call it that, on location of things. And let's say BlackBerry has hosting data here and there and the other. That sometimes falls into the purview of the ITU and what they talk about and so on. ICANN doesn't get into that discussion. However, recently with the new GTLD program, you're tending to find these discussions start to emerge. And recently with the Snowden revelations and the issue about privacy of who is issues, you're tending to find that discussion seeping in to the GAC discussions now. And you're quite right that the countries who have different laws are interested in what ICANN is doing, not GAC, what ICANN is doing about these kinds of things. I think the jury is still out as to how that's going to emerge. This whole IANA transition process is, in fact, part of that discussion about transitioning from, you know, a U.S. corporation to post-transition ICANN that is fully globalized and so on. I believe you're going to see some more thinking along those lines. The GAC doesn't have a view as a GAC. Countries have views. But I do believe the underlying view within the GAC is that ICANN must respect international law. Now, the definition of international law is another issue. But that's the underlying thinking. And what international law means and what countries' laws, individual countries' laws mean, is another discussion to have. But there's always a thought process that ICANN should respect those countries' laws. Obviously, there's a jurisdictional issue with ICANN, where it's located and what it can do. But beyond that, it should be neutral and speaking to strictly the issue about the DNS and the roots and so on, and not necessarily about where data is hosted and how data moves. And if you're talking about encryption and that kind of thing, you're talking about content, and you're moving into a whole different type of discussion that ICANN is not supposedly involved in. And even though you may hear them talking about it, but they do state that they're not a regulator, and they're not a content, they don't deal with content. So that's for a different forum. So you won't see, although the GAC may try to bring that up as an issue, it's not supposed to be an issue that but the GAC itself, using the GAC as an entity, countries in the GAC are free to do what they want. So they're free to bring those issues up and free to have positions, if necessary, discussed. the question is whether ICANN itself would see it as part of their portfolio or not. And I think that would be a discussion between ICANN board and the GAC itself, if that advice ever was to be given.
Claudine Sugira from Rwanda. I just wanted to ask, I have gone for the GAC sessions and some have been heated up and a bit intense. How does the GAC reach consensus when members are not agreeing? Yeah.
Repeat exactly, very carefully. So the process of consensus, actually it's if you are a student of anything like politics or negotiation, going to a GAC meeting, especially now and tomorrow, will be, well, maybe not tomorrow because they close the but now, if you're going now and tomorrow, where they're drafting in the open text to respond to the accountability proposal, you would see in action how consensus is done in the GAC. It's close to what you see in the UN or other organizations, but not exactly the same because it's a little less formal. However, the concept of consensus is that everybody loses, right? That's the kind of concept that nobody feels that they've won, so everybody loses and nobody's happy. Everybody's equally unhappy.
Yes.
That's the kind of thinking. So, if you use that as the prime rationale for getting to consensus, then nobody should be smiling, and there should be a lot of arguing. But as the previous GAC chair, who I learned a lot from, said that what can you live with?
Yeah.
I think that's the concept of consensus. Okay, guys, we're all arguing. Talking about this word and that word, and square bracketing this and doing that, and option A and option B.
I'm getting chills.
Yes. So after all of that, let's all calm down. What can you live with? And that's the best I could get it to you. So if you think about that and how people operate, that's what's and the role of the chair and vice chair is important in that regard. Getting countries who don't agree to agree to disagree, and what can they live with? And that's how consensus is built. It may take days, it may take hours, but at the end of the day, we've always reached some level of halfway consensus. And in the end, there's the possibility of the GAC bylaws give you a range of views out. So whether you reach consensus or not, you're able to then say, some countries expressed a view on this and said this, and other countries did not. And it's a traditional in the GAC, and I think in other fora, to not name the countries. So you don't say that country A or country B had this view and country C had this view. And I think that's a tradition. So consensus is built using almost anonymity, and the GAC, using the big GAC now, comes to that kind of rough consensus in that regard.
Don't use the word rough consensus.
I'm guided.
So, go ahead.
Hello, I'm Sonam from Bhutan, and I came to know yesterday that my country is not a member of a GAC, and I would like to know how approach my government, how do I realize them that ICANN is important, where we can have it's a community base where, and it's for the policies. And my second question is, because we are from a developing country and they'll ask for the fund, well, how is it? And that's for sure. I'm sorry to say that. They will be the second question for me. So on third questions, what are the what are the policies discussed? And because I need to make sure them to come into the ICANN world, because so these are, I need to get some information so that I can reach out to my government. And that's
okay. I can't remember the second question, but I'll deal with the first one, which is if your country is not in the. Not a member, what you do. I believe the easiest thing right now is to work with the ICANN vice president or manager for that region, that area, because they do have meetings with the government on regular occasions. Right. And So if it's you meet with this individual, that's Asia Pacific, so it should be Jiarong, and there's also Save, who is he's the Vice VP, right?
VP for Oceania.
Oceania, right? Yeah. Okay, so if you meet with whoever it is, it's Jiarong. You meet with them, and his next trip to that country or to a meeting where that country may be there, he may be able to speak to that individual and say, you know, there's this thing called ICANN and so on and so forth. And it may not be that individual he's speaking to who's going to be the GAC rep, but at least he will make the importance of the GAC clearer and so on. In terms of travel support, but I'm not sure what's the exact question. Yeah.
So as far as GAC travel support goes, unless it's changed, which I don't think that it has, the GAC is allocated 30 slots, and it's 30 slots to, like you said, developing economies. It's the rules aren't the same as the fellowship program as far as how it goes, but the criteria is based on that.
Yeah.
It was written in the same, and the way that you request that is once you're a member of the GAC, there is is it still a call for requests and all of that? And there's a call for requests for travel support, and then they're selected by the selection committee within the GAC, and it's airfare, hotel, and it's the same basic idea. And then the third question was about the policies that are discussed in the GAC, which is, Tracy, go ahead.
So that's, going to the GAC website, you'll actually see a one of the most important things to look at are the topic areas, as well as the register of advice. So the register of advice gives you a sort of a historical overview of what the GAC has been discussing, everything from wine and vin to, to .XXX, to who is this used, to safeguards for due to TLDs, to, it's a whole range of issues. Today and in the last few days, they're all discussing accountability, but they're squeezing in some CCTLD issues here and there, squeezing in some issues related to the ALAC and working on meeting B. So it's a range of topics that they discuss. The agendas are published pretty publicly, and you can look at them. And I believe after this meeting, there should be a return to what the GAC would be normally doing, would be like about 5 or 6 topic areas per meeting. Right now it's pretty much one area they're discussing because they need to get this thing out. So it's a bad meeting to look at what they're doing. It's a bad example. But after this meeting, we should go back to, you know, there's a structured agenda with 5 or 6 areas. And I think that's the first meeting in some time. We'll be going back to normal after new GTLD program. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Same as working of the ICANN and GAC. ICANN works like bottom-up approach takes community on board, and governments usually work on top-down approach. So my question to you is that what influence does GAC carry on the policies of ICANN and vice versa? Like what ICANN's policies or ICANN influence has on GAC's decisions or policies? Thank you.
First of all, GAC doesn't make policy. The GAC gives advice. So that's GAC's limitation. And I would probably disagree with you in saying that governments are all top-down. I think a lot of governments think they are certainly more bottom-up than maybe you're given credit for. So I wouldn't necessarily say that every government in the world is top-down. However, I'm sure there are some that are. The thinking is that the GAC, as you're calling it, the GAC is still a set of governments. The GAC doesn't make policy. The GAC advises on policy. I will try and answer your question a little differently. The GAC has been caught off guard several times by ICANN policy. ICANN's policy is made by the SOs, and they normally come in very late in the game and review that policy, and then I'll have to make critical decisions on it or provide advice. So what they're doing now to use the bottom-up approach, the GAC itself has realized that it can't continue just advising after the fact. So they're actually coming into the process much earlier, calling it early engagement, GAC early engagement, and involving themselves in the PDP. I'm sure you've heard about the PDP already, Jeannie. Yes? So the PDP and having GAC members in the process very early so that they can comment along the way, again, sort of bottom-up in that regard. Reverse liaisons are up, exactly. So there's supposed to be a GAC liaison to the GNSO and a GNSO liaison to the GAC, and those types of things are starting to create new ways of working so that when a policy comes up, GAC doesn't have to give advice at the last minute and create a contentious issue between the SO and itself. So I don't know if that answers your question, because it's difficult to answer from a GAC, because again, GAC is multiple governments. And I can't say the GAC itself has one way of working in terms of policy, because it doesn't make policy. It only issues advice.
So to bring it back around to the earlier question as well, when you think about the policies that the GAC is talking about and that the GAC is working on, it's the same basic idea as what the rest of the ICANN community is working on. The GAC is talking about the same things in their room that the GNSO is talking about in their room. They're just talking about it from a public policy perspective, anything that is impacting their national governments or international law. So it's completely from a different perspective. So the GNSO may be looking at it, and their different constituencies may be looking at how is this affecting my business. So I'm going to be involved in this PDP on the basis of that. How is this affecting my nonprofit? ALAC is looking at it. How is this affecting end users? The GAC is looking at it. How is it affecting not just governments, but how is it affecting the national laws of the country that I'm in, the country that I'm the government for, and the government representative, and that's what Tracy was talking about earlier. Why, in GAC meetings, so often they have to go back and say they're listening to what the GNSO, when the GAC is meeting with the GNSO, they hear, they think about it, they go back and they say, the GNSO has brought this in front of us, now we have to advise on it. So this early engagement really is important, because what they're actually doing is becoming more involved in the process so much earlier, not necessarily influencing the process because the GAC is still an advisory committee, but they're getting an earlier view into a PDP before it's completed. They're not providing advice on the PDP before it's completed, but they know that it's coming. They're getting a heads up, basically, and they know they'll have an idea and be able to frame their work and their discussions around it rather than having a... Has anybody read a PDP? It's a long document. And to have to prepare for that, and since the GAC generally, as often as they do meet via email, and the GAC comes to consensus face-to-face. I don't think that's changed in the time that I have stopped working with the GAC, but the GAC comes to consensus face-to-face, and this meeting, this day may feel long, but it's a short time. It's a week-long meeting for 161 governments to come to consensus on some serious policy issues to see how these issues are affecting their constituents at home. So does that clarify things a little bit more? So when they're providing advice to the ICANN board to say this is how it's affecting the GAC, or this is how it's affecting governments, laws, et cetera, we're advising the ICANN board to say you might want to think about this before you implement this policy. And so then the board, per the ICANN bylaws, has to consider that advice and then come back to the GAC and say, we've accepted your advice, we're going to implement the PDP with these things in mind, or we're going to go back to the GNSO and say, hey, guys, think about this a little bit more, or we're not going to implement. And so it's a process that is lengthy. PDPs are lengthy. The GAC advice process can also be lengthy. If the board rejects the advice, they have to give a rationale. There has to be some discussion between the GAC and the board. Essentially, an understanding has to be made. The GAC needs to explain to the board why it's important. The board needs to explain why they're rejecting the advice, whether it's on legal reasons or we can't accept this advice because it's based on the laws of one area or et cetera, et cetera. So it's an interesting process to really watch.
So Ginny hits on the issue of public interest. So that comes back straight to your point. The GAC and governments in the GAC strongly believe that they are working in the public interest. Whether you agree with that or not, it's not, I guess, not a question. Governments, as an entity, believe that that is their job. They work in the public interest. The definition of what the public interest is something contentious, and that is something that even the accountability process has been brought out, that every constituency and even constituents might have a different definition of public interest. The governments of the view that public interest and public policy are this, or equals to this. And from a government perspective, it's a final view, because public policy and public interest is what they set as governments. Some people might call it national policy in their jurisdictions, and national interest, that they might use those words, which is, when I raised that with the GNSO, that got very confusing, because public policy might not equal to national policy in their view. And that's where the bit of a contention lies. So some work to be done there. And I think once everybody gets to understand that nuance and understand each other's view, then your question about whether the GAC is working in line with ICANN or ICANN working in line with GAC might be a better fit. Because at that point, people understand each other, understand what they're talking about, and then they might be working together. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Halafon from Ethiopia. Ethiopia. Yeah. I am also from the government, and I know my government is not in the GAC. So I'm asking this question. Is there any requirement that who is going to endorse this application? Because I know a case, we have two departments in our government. We have a separate government agency dealing with cybersecurity and a separate Ministry of ICT. So the head of this cybersecurity agency applied to this GAC membership, and they did not get any response yet. I asked this about this to Bob, who is the African stakeholder engagement manager, and he told me that the Minister of ICT may endorse it. So is there any requirement who should endorse to be maybe the Prime Minister, or any requirement on that? Another question is, why is the role of GAC limited to be advisory? So governments may see this
boom
if they are not...
It was such an easy question at the beginning.
All right, the first question is, so the GAC secretariat and the GAC executive, the leadership, do not get involved in internal issues at home. That's as straightforward as it sounds. What may have happened is that there may be two letters into the GAC saying that their GAC reps are from, you know, we are the GAC rep. That's entirely possible. That may have happened. You might not know that, but that might have happened. That's happened before. What would likely may have happened then is that they may have written back to anyone or both of them and said that, politely, please resolve this. Because if you want to be the GAC rep or a GAC rep, it should come from an authority. So a minister is as high as you can go, I would imagine, or the prime minister, or like a permanent secretary equivalent in your ministry, or head of, or CEO, or something like that. The secretariat slash executive will accept that as a GAC rep. They don't get involved. They don't question whether it's from the Ministry of ICT, Ministry of Cybersecurity. If the government says that's a GAC rep, that's a GAC rep. If it is that there are two letters or three letters or four ministries, or that has happened before, Jeannie, you know that, are saying that this is the GAC rep, you might find no action being taken because there's clearly contention. And again, the GAC leadership doesn't decide who is the GAC rep between, well, that's more ICT, so that should be the GAC rep, or they don't do that. Or it doesn't say, if the minister wrote, that's definitely the GAC rep versus the CEO who wrote, that's lesser, so... That's not the role of the secretariat or the leadership. So you may find there's some contention there. Again, I guess it'll be very useful to work with your vice president to resolve that, because that may be more of a role for the ICANN staff to liaise with the government to indicate that it could be. There are many cases where there are multiple GAC reps from a country. There's a rep and an alternative, and they're from different agencies. Yeah, once they call an advisor, they may be from, like the regulator might have a rep, might be on the GAC as from a country A, and the ministry will be there as well. They both can both come to meetings. They may not even know each other, but they'll know, they'll meet at the meeting. Things like that have happened before. And it's not something that the GAC executive or the, or secretary can control, but it's happened before. Second question.
I'm not taking it.
So there's the debaters, and again, if you go to the GAC meeting now and tomorrow morning, you'll probably hear that discussion going on about it's really the focus of what the GAC is discussing now. So why are they only advisory? Well, let me say carefully that the Governmental Advisory Committee does not exist on its own. It's a creature of ICANN. It's not the ITU. So ICANN has decided that it would like to accept, receive advice from the governments, and they've created an advisory committee. And therefore, to receive advice, that's the ICANN bylaws, and the GAC has its own bylaws, which are guided by the ICANN bylaws. Whether or not that is considered to be fair or equitable by the government is another question. But the debate has been going on now ever since, again, I guess, the WSIS-type discussions, and recently with the last WSIS, in December, last WSIS high-level meeting, talking about people being equal footing, right? So that has always been the reverse, in that in the UN system, it was always perceived that civil society and other actors were not on equal footing with governments. So that decision, that statement is kind of the reverse, to place the actors on equal footing in their respective roles. That's what happens. Now, in the ICANN world, it appears to be different. Appears to be, I'm saying that carefully, because according to governments, some bodies, these are some body, meaning the ESOs, for example, can make policy, whereas governments can only, using the word in quotes, issue advice. Now, I'm going to be careful and say I don't want to pronounce it, but what's the difference between that? However, if you look carefully at the bylaws, you will see that, in my own opinion, there may not be much difference in terms of equality of what's happening. Because advice, as Jeannie was pointing out earlier, needs to be considered by the board along with policy and carefully considered. And in some cases, they need to go back to the policy-making body, say, based on GAC advice, which is issued in the public interest, please make these changes. In some people's views, that's more powerful than policy. It comes after the fact. It's more powerful. Now, other people may think, well, no, it's the governments may think that it's less powerful because we don't make policy. Jury's out on that. Major discussion happening. There are views on, you know, here, there, and everywhere on it. And if you want to hear those views in live, visit, go tomorrow and hear, because that's what's happening right now. That discussion is going on as we speak, as to what's happening on that topic.
So we probably have time for one. Okay, two more questions. Three more questions. Three more questions. That's it. I'm cutting it off at three. I'm cutting off at three, and I've already got my three in the queue. So. Oh my gosh! Do I have to have four? Was there?
Okay, so basically, that's Fabrizio. My name is Fabrizio Pessoa from Brazil. So basically, yesterday I was actually today I watched part of the discussion about public security or something like that. Safety, public safety. Yeah, and I saw that they explained some very basic things, kind of like how an IP works and things like that, which made me think that maybe the knowledge of people from that are there as GAC representatives is not the same. About they don't really have the same knowledge about the everything that's going on here. And thinking about that, and adding that to something that I heard yesterday and during the public forum, that one guy said that when will ICANN be more powerful than government? You know, because basically there are some things that the governments say that ICANN can just say no. And isn't it something that somehow unfair if you have some countries where you know that you have some people that are very aware of what's going on and how things work, and other people that they are not that aware on the same place trying to get into a consensus about something. So, and again, on the top of that, is there some kind of a training, kind of background training or something like that for GAC representatives so that they are more aware of how things work and what's going on?
So I could answer yes and yes. The two answers are very easy. So that issue has been peculiar, especially for developing countries. So you tend to find in a GAC meeting, if you go, I'll be honest, maybe out of 100 people who are there, 10 countries may speak for the entire meeting, and the same 10, maybe even less. And the other countries are silent, and it's not that they might know what's going on. That's one aspect of it. They may not be able to speak on the topic because they don't have a position yet. That's one issue. And just as well, they may not be knowledgeable, right? That's true. So that's been recognized by the GAC as the GAC, and they have formed an underserved regions working group, which capacity building is a big part of. And while we've tried to do capacity building before, with new members in particular, it's still not sustainable. You know, there's no way you can go and get information for the GAC specifically on demand. You can go to ICANN, learn and get information on ICANN, but maybe the GAC issues are peculiar, maybe they're different, maybe the perspective needs to be nuanced slightly. And that's being fixed, and that's being recognized, and we're working with the ICANN team as well as within the GAC to get that fixed. But it is unfair. I agree. It is unfair that people come into the GAC meeting and they're not fully briefed. And all of that is because even the resources at home in their home countries are not efficient. So it's only one person maybe following an ICANN issue as well as ITU issue, as well as OAS issue, as well as other issues. And they may not have the time to be briefed before a meeting, or they may not understand what they're discussing. And it's very important, I think, for them to be aware so they can participate. So that's correct. And it's true that happens. It is true.
My name is Michael Elisheva from Zambia, from government. My question pertains to GAC working groups. Since Singapore, GAC working groups, since Singapore ICANN 52, the public safety working group was formed. Actually, it was born in Singapore and rectified finally during ICANN 53. From the committees, ICANN already has a security and stability advisory. Under ICANN, there's a security and advisory committee. Security and Stability Advisory Committee, which somehow is doing the same job as the Public Safety and Public Safety Working Group. Why did Public Safety Working Group fall under ESSAC, unlike it falling under government?
So I would strongly disagree with you there. Public safety and security and stability of the root are two different issues. Public safety and law enforcement is a whole different kettle of fish. If you look at the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, there's only, I think, one law enforcement member on that committee right now from Mauritius. And that's an advisory committee made up of X number of people. The Public Safety Working Group of the GAC is made up of GAC members, 160 odd members, which it'll be ideally, as well as their law enforcement agencies. So in some countries, that will be the equivalent of the FBI in the US. So there'll be police, pseudo police or quasi police, military, cyber, CSIRTs and CERTs, ethical hackers, any number of official type organizations that the ESSAC itself doesn't cover. They cover, if you look carefully what they cover, it's the stability of the root. The Public Safety Working Group covers things a little beyond that. Yes, the ESSAC issues are, there will be cross-fertilization, there will be some overlap, but the Public Safety Working Group covers a significant number of issues larger than the ESSAC. For example, the who is issue, ESSAC doesn't cover that. The who is issue is covered by, who else? Who covers who is issue, I think. But it's not ESSAC that covers the who is issue. Public safety, that's one of the major issues right now. So I would disagree that they're the same, and because it's public safety, again, like public interest, it is perceived that the GAC is the natural home for something like public safety as opposed to cybersecurity, which is a little different, or safety or security, which is the specific issue with SAC. Is that clear? Public safety and law enforcement is really what they're dealing with. Yeah?
Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, I know that GAC has a lot of working groups. GAC working group for public safety, you know, underserved regions, all these working groups. Who works in these working groups? Because as far as I know, most of these GAC, they have reps. So, and some of them, I can say they're few, to my view. So, who are those that serve in these working groups? Can I, as a fellow, volunteer in these working groups, as maybe I work for the government in my country, but not a rep, actually? Can I contribute in these working groups, volunteer?
Again, as I said earlier, you should link up with your GAC rep, and that would be, there's no restriction as to who can be in a working group once it's under the GAC aegis, which you're trying to say. So if it is that your GAC rep from your country says that, okay, I would like you to participate in this working group if it's you're a specialist in the area, there'll be, I don't think there's any reason for, Jeannie's going to clarify.
I'm just going to try and clarify. I think what the question is, it's a little bit, GAC working groups operate differently than, say, a GNSO volunteer working group is.
Very different.
So GAC working groups are internal to the GAC.
Correct, yeah.
But if it was if they opened it up as a cross-community working group, there would be an opportunity at some point. But but GAC working groups are generally internal to the GAC.
Yeah.
But to Tracy's point, certainly if you're in your government, link up with your GAC representative
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So I'm not sure if that's clear. So the GAC working groups are not public working groups. They're not at all public. Even the public safety working group is not public. It's a GAC working group that's internal to the GAC. But if you're from government, I'm saying it again, and you are lined with your GAC rep in terms of you understand who it is and you spoke to them and so on, there would be, if it is that the GAC rep says, I would like John Smith as an expert in this area to assist in the GAC working group. I don't think there's really a precedent for it, but I don't think it's going to be a problem if the GAC rep, him or herself, advises the secretariat or the chair that you should be involved. I'm not going to put my hand on the block and say that, but I don't think it's going to be a problem. If the GAC rep, remember the GAC rep is the gateway in.
Last question, and then I need you to just sit tight for just a second after this question's answered, and I need to go through a couple things. It is after time. We are all tired. I am exhausted, too, but we have one more question. This is the very last one. I didn't see your hand up, so I'm sorry about that, but please go ahead.
It's okay. Last question. Since you have mentioned earlier that there are just a number of GAC representatives attending the GAC sessions, would there be any possibility that you do have plans to not force but really encourage and those representatives to come full force in some of the sessions, or maybe when there would be some ICANN events, they will all be there to air their support or maybe have a consensus?
So the question is to encourage the quieter GAC members to speak up in the meetings, or to have an avenue for GAC members to speak up other than the GAC.
One is an avenue, and another one would be encourage the attendance to be 100% as much as possible. Okay.
161 governments.
Yes. Wow. So yes, there is a thrust to have, I think there are 240 countries in the UN or something like that. 200 plus. So there is a thrust to have all countries represented in the GAC. That's one. So that'll be great.
Yes.
There is a thrust to have all GAC countries who are in the GAC come to the GAC meeting. Travel support, unfortunately, is only for 30. So, and it's oversubscribed literally every meeting since I think it went up. It went up from 25 to 30, and it's been oversubscribed.
It went up from
6, 20, 25, 30, oversubscribed every time since then. So there is a lot of interest from the countries who are, I guess, otherwise unable to attend. But it's only 30, so I can't fund 100 odd countries to come. I'm sure they'd love to, but it'll be very difficult, and I'm sure they can't still hold them in a room yet. And yes, and remote participation is available, but we don't have the GAC reps, I think, taking it up as well as we would like. And even if it was taken up, it's not really well. For the discussions that are in the GAC, it's difficult to be following remotely. It really is. The way the discussions work, it's a little difficult. But nonetheless, there is a thrust, and I imagine one day when everything is clicking and working well and there's funding available and there's a room big enough to hold them and so on, there would be 200 odd countries sitting around a table. Imagine that in the GAC room to discuss a GAC communique. That'd be fun. and whether there are avenues outside the GAC. So the public forum is a very good avenue. I do think that the countries who are silent in the GAC room, many of them do speak outside of the GAC in their regions. So there are regional type of meetings that the GAC might have, not called GAC meetings. African governments will meet, Asia-Pacific governments will meet, and so on, and the GAC reps might be there. That's another avenue. And also working in what we call the corridors and the margins, you tend to find a lot of the countries who are not speaking up in the main room, either working in the margins or themselves being called to work in the margins. So if you find that the main countries, let's assume the U.S., which is, you know, a big speaker in the GAC, a big country, they may call the, they may ask a smaller country to come and, you know, let me bounce this off you and hear their view there and so on. And that happens a lot in the coffee breaks, which get very long, and you tend to see them meeting and huddling, and you tend to see the larger countries, either deliberately or otherwise, bringing smaller countries in to talk about issues that they probably want to raise in a meeting, and they may even raise it there or maybe ask to raise an issue and so on. So there are avenues like that traditional government meetings have, that they don't speak there, they can speak to another rep and have their issues raised, because they may not even be able to raise the issue because they may not be authorized to speak on the issue. But if it's an issue that the country has, they can raise it with another rep who's authorized to speak on several issues. Yeah, things like that happen in the GAC.
Tracy, thank you. I thought this was a very, very good discussion. If you see Tracy walking around, if you see Tracy, do not give him a break under my strict orders. I adore Tracy. He's a fellow, so give him a little bit of a break, but definitely stop him. Stop him, ask him questions, get him, if he can, he probably knows who your GAC rep is. He can at least point you in the right direction. And I probably know who your GAC rep is too, so.
I'm happy to. I'm very happy to.
So, anything that any of us can do. And, again, if your avenue is through your regional representative, that's my team. So I know all of them. So, and they're scared of me. So I will tackle them in a hallway and, I will make sure that your regional representation at ICANN knows who all of you are. A couple of housekeeping things before I set you free. The first one is tomorrow morning, bright and early at 7 o'clock.
Yes, we're going to have, down in the other room that we were in the morning, we're going to have ESSAC at 7, RSAC at 7:30, the business constituency right after that, and then we're going to hear from the IPC. So we're going to have another packed morning tomorrow. So please come prepared with any questions that you might have for those constituencies and advisory committees that we're going to hear from. The IPC is the intellectual property constituency, by the way. Also, ladies, come take a picture with me. It's International Women's Day before I let you go. So, men, you can go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you sure?